Lecture 20, Wuli at Ur.
In this lecture, we move back to Mesopotamia. We begin the story in the 1870s, when Sumerian civilization, arguably the earliest in the world, was first discovered in Mesopotamia. It was soon recognized that it was as early, if not earlier, than the beginnings of ancient Egypt. Then next, we move to the 1920s, to the main meat of this lecture, and describe Leonard Woolley's excavations at the biblical city of Ur in southern Iraq. We delineate the circumstances of the excavation, the discovery of the royal cemetery, and Woolley's deep trench, which revealed what he claimed to be the biblical flood. The lecture takes a tour of an urban precinct in Woolley's company and analyzes his comprehensive excavation methods. You see, Ur was one of the last excavations which employed hundreds of workers, a style of excavation which no longer is fashionable. And then finally, we place these most famous of early excavations in a modern scholarly context. You'll recall that Jules Oppert, the French scholar, one of the decipherers of cuneiform, was the first to identify a much earlier Sumerian civilization in southern Mesopotamia, far earlier than the Assyrians and the Babylonians, a civilization whose legends were preserved in Babylonian literature. In 1877, a Frenchman, Ernest de Sarzec, who was born in 1836 and died in 1901, was appointed the French consul in Basra on the Persian Gulf. Like Botha, whom we described much earlier, Sarzec had a lot of leisure time. Basra was not exactly a busy place, and he spent this leisure time exploring the ancient city mounds of southern Mesopotamia and collecting cuneiform tablets which abounded in dealers' stores in the town. On the advice of these dealers, he dug into the Tello Mounds, on an ancient canal between the Tigris and the Euphrates. There he unearthed a rich hall of tablets and other finds, and a temple mound of unbaked brick. Now remember this unbaked brick, because I'm going to come back to it in a moment. Between 1880 and 1900, de Sarzec excavated at Tello almost every year. He recovered numerous bas-reliefs and inscriptions, which identified Tello as ancient city of Lagash, an important Sumerian state. Now, de Sarzec's excavations were crude, largely because he was unable to decipher the intricacies of unfired mud brick. That is, mud brick which was dried by being dried in the sun rather than being fired in a kiln. He didn't find much more than large antiquities, but what he did find was spectacular statues of early kings of Lagash. And when he left his excavations, they were soon looted by dealers. But de Sarzec's work was terribly important because it established the existence of a hitherto unknown Sumerian civilization, one of the earliest civilizations in the world. Importantly, too, his work stimulated more research in southern Mesopotamia. For example, from 1888 to 1900, the University of Pennsylvania Museum in Philadelphia excavated biblical Kalmi, the city of Nippur, and probed down to the lowest levels, recovering more than 30,000 Sumerian tablets in the process. These included at least 9 Sumerian epics, among them the famous Epic of Gilgamesh. This epic described ancient Sumerian cities like the city of Uruk. In Uruk, says the Epic of Gilgamesh, the god built walls, a great rampart, and the temple of Blessed Diana. Look at it still today. It shines with the brilliance of copper, and the inner wall, it has no equal. clearly a spectacular civilization of high achievement. And yet, so little was known about it, very largely because of the problem of unfired brick. The breakthrough came when German archaeologist Robert Calderway excavated Babylon. You recall that Claudius, James, Rich, Layard, and others were baffled by Babylon. Why? Because it appeared just to be dusty mounds, and there weren't the bas-reliefs and the easily identified palaces you find among the Assyrians, for example. But Calderway was persistent, and he realized that the problem was unfired brick, and he developed a technique of excavating by using picks and feeling the texture of the soil, and he found there was a difference between unfired mud brick and just soil. And he was able to trace walls, and as a result of this, between 1899 and 1922, this quiet, highly competent archaeologist reconstructed part of biblical King Nebuchadnezzar's city. He did it by following mud brick walls, and he reconstructed some of the gates and precincts of the city, including the famous gate of the goddess Ishtar, which you can see in a museum in Germany to this day. Mud brick, a very tricky form of excavation. When I tell you today that the best way of excavating this is to use compressed air, you will understand some of the big problems involved in this sort of excavation. There's a delicacy of touch and experience, and so much of archaeological excavation involves experience involved with mud brick. And so it came to pass, after World War I, with considerable experience now available, both the British Museum and the University of Pennsylvania Museum were anxious to resume excavations in what was rapidly becoming the modern country of Iraq. And they organized a joint expedition to excavate the site of biblical color, Ur of the Chaldees. And as the leader of this excavation, and there was no debate over this, they chose Leonard Woolley. Leonard Woolley of Carchemish fame. Let's just go back a bit on Leonard Woolley and give you a little background here. We discussed his work at Carchemish in an earlier lecture. But let's just reiterate that he was born in 1880. He died in 1960. He was told by the warden of his college at Oxford to become an archaeologist and did so. He learned his excavation in the Sudan. And while digging at Carchemish, which, as I said, we described in Lecture 16, there he learned a number of things. Firstly, he learned how to work with large numbers of laborers and only a few experts, something he also did at Ur. He also developed an extraordinary trust with his foreman, Hamoudi, Sheikh Hamoudi, with whom he worked for a lifetime. He also mastered the art of dealing with laborers and the art of dealing with very volatile political situations, because southern Iraq was not an easy place to work. The climate was horrendous. It was windy, it was cold, and the people were very unruly. So he needed an extraordinary strength of character, a charisma, to master this army of people who worked for him. Woolley was small of stature, but he had a tremendous presence, and he was also an absolutely consummate storyteller. His stories became somewhat enlarged in the telling, but they were wonderful. And a trip round Ur, the Ur excavations, in the company of Leonard Woolley was something one never, ever forgot. The Ur excavations lasted from 1922 to 1934 and were organized on a truly large scale. This was one of the truly enormous excavations, one of the last of them. And it was done under the circumstances, with great panache and brilliance. Woolley uncovered entire crowded urban precincts. investigated the massive ziggurat or temple mound, dated it with inscriptions in its foundations to about 2300 BC. But his two most famous discoveries came somewhat later in the excavations. Because like any archaeologist who digs a big city mound, one of the fundamental questions is, how old is it? And the only way you can find out how old it is to dig down to the bottom. And Woolley's most famous trench at Ur was a huge pit which penetrated down to the very base of the city mound. He passed through thick, sterile layers caused by river flooding. Then down at the bottom, uncovered a teeny hamlet with distinctive painted pottery. This settlement was founded in about 5,000 BC, 2,000 years before Sumerian civilization. This was an enormous piece of excavation. And one of the reasons, of course, that Woolley could excavate with so many people was that wages were cheap. Even back in the 1960s, when I excavated in Africa, we were paying laborers about 38 cents a day, which was the government rate. We could afford to employ as many people within reason as we wished. He was in the same situation on a much larger scale. And this was why he could dig this huge hole. And here were these thick flood deposits. And he was puzzling over them one day when his wife, Catherine, walked by. And he said to her, I can't make out what these deposits mean. They're just flood deposits. And she said, well, of course, it's the biblical flood. And lights went off. And Woolley promptly started writing about the existence of the biblical flood at Ur. Now, Woolley was a brilliant communicator. He was a brilliant popularizer. He had the gift both in lecture, he would have been wonderful for the teaching company, both in lecture and in writing to really make the past come alive. And when Woolley said that he had found evidence of a flood, and perhaps the biblical flood, a large number of people, especially the devout, sat up and took notice. And his claim not only raised widespread interests, but helped him raise money for the excavation, because one of the constant problems was finding money to continue digging on such a large scale. Woolley himself was a consummate scholar. He lived long enough for later research to show that the Ur flood was merely one of many floods to afflict southern Mesopotamia's cities. And in any case, it was too early to be the biblical flood. But at the time, it caught the popular imagination. Leonard Woolley was a brilliant excavator by the standards of the day. For a man who was impatient and very charismatic, he could exercise extraordinary patience. In 1922, one of the early trenches yielded golden objects. A gold in any archaeological excavation is an event. It's an event from the security point of view, and it's an event from the point of view of what this means. And Woolley realized at once that almost certainly he had found a royal cemetery. And this is why he was a great archaeologist, he waited for 4 years to gain more experience of the site and for his workmen to gain more experience of the site before he excavated into the royal cemetery. This, by any standards, was a remarkable discovery and a remarkable achievement. For a start, the excavators cleared more than 2,000 commoners' burials, most of them buried with a little matting and almost no ornaments. This, for all the lack of spectacular finds, is difficult trying excavation because you try and recover the bones intact. And then he excavated no less than 16 royal graves using teams of specially trained workers. He moved them in sequences. One group of excavators would clear the outline of the tomb, another lot would clear the bones, and so on. A sequence of people would work it through, whereas he himself did the most delicate work. And Leonard Woolley, with this excavation, discovered what he called a series of death pits. These burial pits chronicled elaborate funeral ceremonies where dozens of courtiers, dressed in their finest regalia, filed into the pits and took up their positions outside the stone-built burial chamber where the royal personage and slaves or concubines lay, the latter sacrificed to accompany their master or mistress into the other world. And Woolley described how these dozens of courtiers, all wearing the regalia of their position in court and their finest raiment, lined up in the correct positions in the burial chamber. They drove carts hauled by oxen into the bottom of the pit, the grooms at the head of the animals. Presumably, there was music and drumming and chanting and incense. And at a signal, everybody drank the poison which was in the clay vessels they were carrying and lay down in order in the great pit to die with their master or mistress. And sometime later, somebody slipped down to the pit and slaughtered the draft animals hauling the wagons. And then the pit was filled in. Layer by layer, other sacrifices were made, and the pit was closed. The excavations revealed, among others, the excavation of the graves of Prince Mesh Kalam Shahar, buried in a gold helmet in the form of a wig, and the sepulchre of a woman named Puabi. She wore an elaborate wig-like headdress, which was reconstructed after months of conservation work, and on several occasions adorned the head of Catherine Woolley, Leonard Woolley's wife. There's only one problem with this reconstruction of the Ur funerals. Not the efforts at conservation, which were extraordinary. For example, in one spot, Woolley found a hole in the ground. He poured plaster of Paris into it and was able to recover the shape of a long-vanished wooden lyre, a musical instrument inlaid with shell, and was able to reconstruct it. His excavations, by the standards of the day, were carried out remarkably carefully. There's another problem, though, with the funerary reconstruction. His notes on the excavation are so incomplete by modern standards that modern experts are unable to establish whether, in fact, this remarkable reconstruction is really true. Was his vivid reconstruction in his imagination, or was it something which really was in the ground? And this is so often a problem with archaeology, the problem of documenting your discovery. But it will live in history as one of the immortal reconstructions of ancient Sumeria. Leonard Woolley, as I've said, was a gifted storyteller and a writer. He had the ability to captivate popular audiences. He was a style of Englishman who no longer exists really today. A man so charismatic that people would sit at his feet and follow him anywhere. It is said that a tour through the excavated precincts of a part of Ur with Woolley was a truly living experience. He would pause at the entrance of a house, step over the sill, and point to the tablet or the inscription which identified the owner of the house. And he would walk through and say, this was a store, this was part of the bazaar, this was the home of a baker, and point out why he knew this, so that in a way these sterile ruins became a living history. He had the disadvantage that he was working at Ur at a time when the popular furor was all over Tutankhamun. And in a way, the royal cemetery at Ur has always been overshadowed by Tutankhamun, which is a pity, because in many ways, the Ur excavations were just as spectacular, and certainly in many ways a far greater challenge to excavate, because you were reconstructing a city from heaps of mud. You found spectacular finds, but the real essence of this was the recreation of a Sumerian temple and a Sumerian city. Leonard Woolley was a very serious scholar indeed. He brought the Sumerians not only to an enormous public audience, and many of his books on Ur are still in print to this day, but he also wrote a 10-volume technical monograph on Ur, which is only read by a handful of specialists. So he fulfilled his responsibility within the limitations of his time to the scholarly community. Because one of the lessons of this whole course and of all these discoveries is how few of them have really been described thoroughly. Ur is one of the few. Tutankhamun is not one of them, because Tutankhamun remains effectively and comprehensively unpublished, even if the artifacts are familiar to most of us from pictures in magazines like National Geographic. Few archaeologists ever mastered Woolley's pace of work, his ability to handle local workers, and his flair, not only for brilliant discovery, but for thriving on it. We have portraits of him from numerous people, among them Gertrude Bell, whose life we described earlier in this course, who became the director of antiquities for Iraq, was the founder of the Iraq Museum, and numerous people who were there tell us how Woolley and others dreaded the days when Gertrude Bell came to visit to inspect the excavations and supervise the division of the finds between the British Museum, the University of Pennsylvania Museum, and Iraq. Generally, however, Woolley said, "We worked out okay," and one has this image of two very strong personalities. On the one hand, the elegantly dressed Gertrude Bell, and on the other, the diminutive, charismatic Woolley, butting heads and backing off with a good compromise. Among the other people there was a young archaeologist called Max Mallowan, who went on to become a very, very eminent archaeologist in Britain. He subsequently excavated again at Nimrud, following in Austin Henry Layard's footsteps with the Assyrians, and he found some remarkable Assyrian ivories, which became world famous. He is in some ways more famous, though, for his marriage. One of the people who visited the excavation was a lady called Agatha Christie, who became the famous detective novelist. She married Max Mallowan and wrote a book called Murder in Mesopotamia, which revolved around an excavation. And if you look closely at that book, you can see closely the characters who were in this small, intimate European community at Ur, who fought and argued and married one another, who often unified in a violent dislike of Leonard Woolley's wife, who was a very controversial figure. She was an artist and very difficult. And this book kind of keeps the excavation living. It's one of the great excavations of all time, simply, if nothing else for the important discoveries, simply because of the personalities who worked there. But the image of the Sumerians which it presented has changed. Since World War II, archaeologists from many nations have added many details to the picture of Sumerian civilization drawn from the Ur excavation. Thousands of tablets from many sites have been deciphered as the work of uncovering the secrets of Sumerian civilization continues. They are even now working on a Sumerian dictionary, of which one or two volumes so far have appeared. In addition, people have increasingly looked at Sumerian civilization on a wider context. We know now that it was part of a much larger, emerging, more global world, where the city-states of Sumeria were connected to states on the eastern Mediterranean shore, had sporadic contacts with Egypt and with the Indus Valley in India, or rather Pakistan, I should say, to be correct, and with the highlands of Iran. There was an enormous network of different cities and city-states constantly at a distance, trading and interacting. And this trade continued whatever the political nuances and the warfare of the days. And, as with Egypt, today we have a picture of a civilization which is not just monuments, not just ziggurats like Ur, not just floods, but a mosaic of city-states that fought with one another, rose to prominence, then went down to obscurity. A civilization that was eventually overwhelmed by Akkadians from Babylon. A civilization where people loved and hated, were healthy and sick, got married, were truant school children, farmed, had crop failures, went into debt, and so on. All the complicated interactions of urban societies which we see to this day. The Sumerians teach us that in many ways there is nothing new in the world of humanity. Most important of all, though, the Ur excavations in the Way were the end of an era. They were really the last of the great heroic excavations. Excavations which took one archaeologist out to a remote land, where a foreigner worked with local labourers, but did nothing to train local archaeologists. It was only really after the 1920s, and particularly after the 1950s, that local archaeologists began to assume ever greater importance in the discovery and study of ancient civilizations. For example, thanks to the work of Egyptian scholars, we now have a magnificent cemetery at Baharia, which shows much about Greek-Roman Egyptians. We now know from modern researches that Sumerian civilization flourished between the Tigris and Euphrates in one form or the other long before 3000 BC. And indeed, modern research, much of it done by local people, suggests that the Egyptian and Sumerian civilizations developed at about the same time, around 3100 BC. Which one was earlier is a somewhat academic question. But it does seem that cities, as a logical way of living, cities which were the ancestors of places like Ur, began to develop in Mesopotamia around 4000 BC. Why? Because a certain degree of scale, particularly when dealing with irrigation agriculture and needs of defense and above all access to water, as well as organization of irrigation works, requires denser populations and probably the infrastructure of a city with its priests and officials to make it work well. And this may well have been one of the genesis of the city, cities like Ur. But the Ur that Woolley excavated was a later city. What we are now beginning to study more and more are the origins of these cities 1,000 years earlier. And this is the great challenge for the 21st century. Minute excavation on a small scale, much of it probing specific questions like, what were the origins of the city and of the Sumerians? In the next lecture, we're going to pick up the story in a different part of the world. We're going to go to East Asia to describe the discovery of the Shang civilization in northern China, a discovery that unfolded while Woolley worked at Ur. This is a story not necessarily of large-scale excavation, but piecing together clues which came from myth, legend, and archaeology working together.